From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And once again, we start with national politics from an Illinois perspective. Last week, Republicans in Congress averted a full government shutdown with the help of 10 Senate Democrats. That number includes Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, who voted with Republicans to advance legislation that will fund the government through September. That's just one of the latest pieces of news out of what has been one of the most active starts to a new presidential administration in generations. In these past few months, one of the most outspoken Democrats in Illinois' congressional delegation has been Sean Casten. He represents Illinois' 6th District, basically the inner ring west and southwestern suburbs of Chicago, including Orland Park, Burr Ridge, Downers Grove, and Elmhurst. He served in the House since 2019. In order to make our schedules meet, we spoke with Representative Casten Monday afternoon. Congressman Sean Casten, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're coming off last week's big spending fight. What do you think of how things turned out?
Look, I voted emphatically no for that bill on the floor. And as you know, and as I've been explaining to folks out here, we are already in a government shutdown. We're in an illegal government shutdown, but you know, ask a USAID worker if they feel like the government is currently open, or a university that depends on NIH funding, or someone at the Department of Education, right? All of these things are legislation and funding that has been approved by Congress, and you cannot rescind that without an act of Congress. And yet the White House is doing this with the confidence for now that the Republican leadership in Congress is not going to do any oversight. And my feeling, and I think the feeling of the Democrats in the House, was not that we want to shut down the government, but if you are going to bring forward a bill that makes all those things worse, you're going to have to negotiate with us. You can't just jam this through. And we were pushing to try to get all our colleagues to say, let's push for negotiation, and you lose all your leverage in negotiation if you just agree to all of the other side's points. And unfortunately, that was what the Senate decided to do. And so we didn't shut the government down, which is good. I think there's a theory that we have lived to fight another day, and I guess we'll have to see whether that day materializes.
I want to read a little from an essay that Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer wrote about his and other Democrats' decision to vote with the Republicans to prevent this, you know, full shutdown, as he frames it. And I should say, this is the New York Times. A shutdown would give Mr. Trump and Mr. Musk permission to destroy vital government services at a significantly faster rate than they can right now. Under a shutdown, the Trump administration would have wide-ranging authority to deem whole agencies, programs, and personnel non-essential, furloughing staff members with no promise they would ever be rehired, end quote. He goes on from there, but how do you respond to his argument that this, it could be worse with a full shutdown?
Well, so my argument, and argument I made with, you know, a lot of my colleagues and friends in the Senate, is that we had three choices, not two. To frame this as saying all we could do is accept what they were offering or shut the government down assumes we have no agency in the process. And I think, you know, with respect to, you know, Leader Schumer, who I do respect, I think he's ignoring the fact that when a bully comes and demands your lunch money, you can say no. And you can still make sure you eat your lunch. But if you don't push back, you're going to get bullied again. And so, as I said, we're in a shutdown right now. That shutdown is going to continue in spite of this CR because we're not doing oversight. Had we said no and said we're only going to make sure that we don't go into a shutdown if you come to the negotiating table in a serious way, maybe we get something better. Is that guaranteed? Of course not. But, you know, we had a chance to play for something with non-zero odds. And instead we bowed down to a bully.
It's this age-old question we've had, and I'm sure you've experienced yourself now time and again in the Congress, of if, you know, two people playing chicken, if one of them unscrews the steering wheel and throws it out the window. Is it not true? How do you think about it, that the Republicans are more eager for government shutdowns, it seems, and disruption in Washington?
I want to avoid drawing quite so broad a brush. In part because when we had bills like this that were brought before the Congress over the last 2 years, certainly, you know, certainly most of the Biden administration, well, the second half of the Biden administration, we didn't have the House. Republicans overwhelmingly voted against these sorts of measures. Every continuing resolution we passed in the last 2 years was, I'm pretty sure I can say every single one was opposed by the majority of the Republican Party. And so I don't want to say that all Republicans think a shutdown is good, or that every CR is good. What was harder in this moment is that with a call from Trump asking them to do things that they opposed just a few months ago, they all bent down. And, I have a lot of Republican colleagues who are not under any confusion as to whether Ukraine is our ally, are not under any confusion as to whether Canada is our friend and full of nice people, but they do not feel the courage to stand up and speak to their values right now. And I just think it's important not to say these people don't share our values. In the moment, they don't share our courage. And I think what we have an obligation to do is to show them what kind of courage and to show that that courage is contagious, not to also bend the knee.
It's interesting how you say that they don't have the courage. What do you understand the reluctance is about? Is it about keeping their jobs, not getting a primary from the right? Is it actually about violence? Some of the people who were pardoned, perhaps, acting as a paramilitary force is some of the darkest speculation I've seen out there about what could be coming our way.
I think it's a little of all of the above. I will share that I had a conversation with one of my Republican colleagues as a friend, and I asked him, what would it take for you to stand up to Trump? And his immediate response without a moment's hesitation was, how did that work for Adam? Referring to Adam Kinzinger. And so I think whether that was a fear that he might, lose his next primary, and there is some noble thought there, right? There are people who say, well, I'm holding the line because somebody crazier than me will take my seat if I lose a primary. In some cases, they are legitimately feared. Donald Trump really did release people from prison who were attacking police on January 6th and mobilizing the Proud Boys, and there's a real fear of that. I guess I can empathize with that, but it doesn't change the fact that I see plenty of Democrats who aren't afraid of that. And whether it's Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger or, my friend Denver Riggleman, there are plenty of Republicans who have shown that they want to be on the right side of history and they want to be able to look their kids in the eye when they go home and say, I did the right thing. But they're not right now.
Let's take a step back. How do you think about the approach that President Trump and Elon Musk are taking to reducing the federal government, stopping spending? We hear the phrase constitutional crisis, illegal behavior. Where are you thinking about this now?
It is a constitutional crisis. It is illegal and is unconstitutional. The Constitution is unambiguous that Congress controls the power of the purse. When Richard Nixon tried to violate that, Congress strengthened those constitutional provisions with the Impoundment Control Act. And Trump is violating both that law and the Constitution. I also think it's important to note that if you are concerned about waste, fraud, and abuse, you wouldn't fire all the inspectors general and the whistleblowers whose job is to be a resource when people working for the federal government see crimes being committed, see ethical lapses, and are in a position where they can bring that to the authority of somebody who can control it. And yet, in fact, that was the first thing that Trump did. So, I think to understand this moment, I find myself thinking back a lot to the wisdom of Justice Brandeis, who, in one of the decisions that essentially made the Sherman Antitrust Act what it is today, he wrote, and this was about life in the 1930s, but it's just as relevant today. And he wrote that when you have great concentrations of wealth in a society, you only have three choices. You can allow the wealth to take over the government, which is to embrace fascism. You can allow the government to take over the wealth, which is to embrace communism. Or you can break up the wealth and embrace competition. And when we are seeing the richest man in the world sitting inside the White House, taking people's individual data so that he can use this, I don't know, to build his own AI engine, trying to shut down parts of NASA so that he can get contracts with SpaceX, and is fully empowered to do that by another billionaire who's, putting out meme coins where there's hundreds of millions of dollars of Chinese money that is flowing directly to the Trump family to buy these coins. We're taking door one, which is to embrace fascism. And that is a constitutional crisis as long as the Republican leadership in the House has decided that they're not going to do any oversight in response to those clear legal and constitutional violations.
I wonder what you're hearing in your district. We've had many conversations on this show now about the Weather Service, about agriculture and tariffs. Just on Monday, we talked to a civil rights lawyer who had been laid off from the Department of Education. What are you hearing in the 6th District about the sort of downstream effects of what Elon Musk and Trump have been doing?
So it's some mix of fear and anger. We've talked to nonprofits who are wondering why their contract with the federal government to plant trees in urban areas is no longer being honored, and what legal obligation they have to subcontractors, since their contract never contemplated that the federal government might not honor the laws of the United States. I've talked to air traffic controllers who are wondering whether they are going to get laid off, whether they are going to be blamed for, you know, whether the crash over the Potomac or others. And, you know, I specifically had a female air traffic controller who said, am I going to be blamed for this because somebody's going to say I was a DEI hire? And all I could say was the last thing I want is for our air traffic controllers to be stressed when they go to work. We've got major national labs. Argonne National Lab is just at the edge of my district. Fermilab is just at the edge of my district. You've got people there wondering if research grants are going to be shut down, particularly as they see that research that's going to universities is being shut down. All of this is illegal, but there's just this tremendous uncertainty. And, you know, one of the scariest conversations I had was someone who came up to me and said, I'm just wondering, since you're in Congress, should I even bother paying my taxes this year? Because it seems like the IRS is getting laid off and Trump isn't going to pay it either. This is a good person, right? Who's basically saying, I don't want to be the sucker in this moment. Now I urged her to pay her taxes. I'm paying my taxes this week as we speak. Like, you know, don't take that attention. But what does it mean when large numbers of good American people are wondering whether the United States government is going, that is in theory a government based on the rule of law, whether the government is going to obey the law?
You hear so much anger out there in the country and fear, as you said, but at least among Democratic constituents, people are hungry for someone to be doing something. You hear that a lot, do something. What does that mean to you? What do you hear from people when, to be fair, the Democrats are in the minority in the Senate and in the House?
So at the last town hall I did, I pointed out to people that, you know, this is a good time to dust off on your old JFK admonition, right? Ask not what your elected officials can do for you, ask what you're going to do for the country. Because all of us have a role in this. And, you know, I take great inspiration as someone who came into Congress in 2019, that we came in on the backs of huge numbers of American people who saw what Trump did the first time and took actions into their own hands, whether that was the March for Women or the bravery that the Parkland students showed in setting up the March for Our Lives. And just getting out there and reminding the American people that we are all in this together, that there's a strength and a beautiful courage in numbers. And I would submit to you, every time we have hit a point like this in our history, we have turned the corner because some grassroots movement rose up, not because someone gave a great speech in Congress. And none of that is to suggest that those of us in leadership positions don't have roles, especially to demonstrate with our own courage, that courage is infectious and contagious, to do what we can to educate the folks out there where we have opportunities to, you know, make some good trouble inside, as, you know, as we did when we forced the release of the Matt Gaetz ethics report earlier this term. And I think we all have roles to play, but, you know, if we're waiting for 270 Democrats in Washington to stand up to the full force of the federal government, we don't have the numbers. On the other hand, if we're looking at the overwhelming, the hundreds of millions of Americans who are really proud of what it means to be an American and want to make sure that they hand this country off to their kids in a little better shape than they found it, we got an overwhelming numbers advantage. And once more into the breach, dear friends.
Do you feel like Democrats, in like yourself, in elected office, are doing enough to communicate with the American people that they understand this is a crisis? I mean, I think people would like set your hair on fire. People really want to understand. And I think that they don't get that impression from all the elected Democrats that are out there.
Well, look, the fact that you're asking the question says no, right? I think all of us have a role to play. To state the obvious, I think there are some There are some members who are comfortable having that conversation. There are some members who are not because of the nature of their districts or their constituents, and that's fine, right? I think it is something that scares a lot of us that to defend the Constitution and the rule of law, to be confident that the good guys won the Cold War, the good guys won World War II, the good guys won the Civil War, all those things are deeply partisan right now. They shouldn't be, but they are. And when all of this falls only to the Democrats to explain that, it can be hard because at the end of the day, all of us have both Democrats and elected and Democrats and Republicans and Whigs and Federalists who vote for us, right? We don't want to be partisan, but we do want to be clear about the stakes. As you can tell from my tone, I'm of the mind that we should be louder and more Churchillian, if you will, about the stakes. But I also respect the fact that not all of my colleagues feel comfortable doing that.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Congressman Sean Casten of the 6th District in the southwest and western suburbs of Chicago. We're going to take a break. We will continue in just a moment. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Congressman Sean Casten, who represents Illinois' 6th District in the United States House of Representatives. I spoke with him Monday afternoon. One of the big questions that's come up for Democrats in the past few months is, why did the party lose in 2024? What does it need to do differently? And the theories have ranged from, to put it bluntly, stop focusing so much on, trans rights, for example, to, creating an alternative media ecosphere to compete with the sort of manosphere podcasts where a lot of everyday Americans get conservative political messaging in their everyday lives, even if, they're not necessarily even listening to explicitly political content. What is your best understanding of where Democrats failed last year?
Well, so I want to first be careful of how we define Democrats. I'm one of about 40 House Democrats who overperformed the top of the ticket. And when we were doing some quick math, if every American who had voted for a Democrat for Congress had also voted for Kamala Harris for president, then Kamala Harris would be president today. And I think that's important to understand because it's very hard to argue that we had a messaging problem. If in fact the voters voted for one message at one spot on the ballot and different message at the other spot on the ballot, I don't think there's any question but that misogyny played some role here. That's unfortunately true, but played a role. I think at the international level, we had global inflation, and every single Democratic election in every country in the world that had Democratic elections in 2024 voted against the incumbent party. And I think that's probably a pithier explanation for why the American people voted against the party that was in power in the Senate, voted against the party that was in power in the White House, and voted against the party that was in power in the House, which is why the Democrats gained seats. There's a lot that comes along with that, of course, and we're all playing defense now. But I think it's important to recognize that if the same broader economic conditions caused a sound rejection of the Tories in the UK and of the Democrats in Washington, it's hard to argue that that was because of some common shared culture war issue, if you will.
Well, what do you think about that, though? So then, do you reject the calls for, whether it's trans healthcare or trans in sport? I mean, that's dominated such a disproportionate share of the conversation, given the actual numbers of people who are trans in our society. But I mean, there are other arguments that you need a more economic populist message from the Democrats. Where do you see, or do you think, steady as she goes? Maybe it was global forces. There was nothing we could have really done that much differently. Don't nominate a woman to the top of the ticket in the future.
Look, I
I don't
mean,
know.
I think there's always a challenge in politics of who is setting the terms of the debate. and what is the debate? I think you would be hard pressed to find a Democrat who was part of their platform was running on trans kids in sports. That doesn't mean that there aren't Democrats who supported the right of every kid to be true to who they are and to make sure that they don't have to worry about some adult coming into the locker room and asking to check their genitals before practice. But that became this issue that got inflamed by the right that dominated the debate in ways that I think it certainly affected how people voted. But this wasn't a core tenet of Democratic messaging. You know, if you look at the things that Democrats were out there campaigning on in the cycle, we were running, I think, with justifiable pride on the fact that we'd passed the biggest infrastructure bill in our history, that that infrastructure bill had strong labor protections that was helping folks in the blue collar professions, that we'd passed the biggest climate bill in our history, that we'd expanded access to health care for folks. That was what we were running on. That, I think, broke through in certain news heavy media environments. It didn't break through as well on TikTok and YouTube. And I think there's a real challenge that, you know, all of my colleagues, including a lot of our consultants, are talking through, that if you look at among people who get their news sources from news outlets, whether that's NPR or CNN or even Fox News, the overwhelming majority of those folks voted for Democrats. Among people who get their news from non-traditional outlets like YouTube, like TikTok, the overwhelming majority of them voted for Republicans. And there is some push to say, well, what do we need to do to get more Democrats into those environments? And that's fine. For my money, I think the hard part is that if you are primarily getting your news from TikTok, you're not going on TikTok primarily to get your news. Like you're that what that says to me is that you're really a very passive follower of the news. And how do you reach somebody who's not actively trying to find out what's going on in the world? And that's a challenge. I think it's a challenge that should be a challenge for all of us, because if we agree there is such a thing as objective truth, how do we make sure that we have a population that makes decisions based on some shared truth if our media environment is so fragmented and atomized and algorithmically driven not to feed us truth, but to feed us things that look like the thing we just said we liked? I think that's a societal challenge that we have to work through. It in this moment, it's partisan, but it doesn't have to be partisan. I mean, there's plenty of strong anti-vax sentiment on the far left, right? Which is just as untrue, but you get it from the same channel of saying, well, if I like this and I like this, it's going to feed me content that gets those endorphins flowing. And I think we've all got a role, all of us who have a device with a share button on it, to be editors and publishers and try to verify things before we share them, and be a little bit more self-critical. And I think we've all got it's a responsibility on all of us as Americans to figure out how to do that a little better.
Last thing I want to ask you about, and it gets to some of the points you were just making there. One of the other overarching theories about what ails America right now is a lack of trust, social cohesion, trust in our institutions. What steps do you think we could be taking to rebuild that trust in our society?
So I'm gonna wax very historical here, if you'll forgive me. The first is that if you read a lot of what our founders talked about when they were before they wrote the Constitution, they spent a lot of time talking about virtue and the idea that a country based on the rule of laws couldn't rely on only electing virtuous people, but it had to fundamentally trust that the majority of the people were virtuous. And that broader collective virtue would lead to positive outcomes. And I say that because that's a basic bet of our democracy, both that we will act virtuously and that we will trust that our neighbors will as well, most of the time. And I think we've got to have that trust or else we're into Mad Max anarchy. The second thing that I'd say, and this would be a fun deeper dive because I don't have the answer to this, but if you look over the course of our history, the last, I don't know, 70 years have been a fairly anomalous period in American history where we actually had some kind of a monoculture. I mean, maybe starting with the JFK Nixon debate and ending with, I don't know, the rise of cable TV, perhaps, or the rise of the internet. It was a fairly brief period that we had a finite number of trusted media sources. Because before that era, you know, We had yellow journalists and pamphleteers and, you know, all of this very disconnected media. And I think it would be interesting to go back in time and say, if you were an American in 1840s Chicago, how did you come to trust, figure out what could be trusted and what was just, you know, the robber baron running your newspaper who was sharing misinformation with you? I don't know what the answer to that is, but I know that we figured that out historically, and maybe we just have to relearn those lessons in this modern, very fragmented, but similarly fragmented environment.
Sean Kasten represents the 6th District in the southwest and western suburbs of Chicago, Illinois. Congressman Kasten, thank you for being with us on the 21st show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.